Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 13th of November, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Well, it's good news, media freedom.
Oh, yes, lots of it, lots of it. We have to go back to July. And if people remember, July, Kim Darroch resigned as the UK ambassador to the USA following the release of emails where he was critical of the Trump administration. So if you remember at the time, he said, we don't really believe this administration is going to become substantially more normal, less dysfunctional, less unpredictable, less faction-riven, less diplomatically clumsy and inept. That's what he had said at the time, and he resigned as a result. These emails were leaked. They were published by the Sunday Mail. And then there were subsequent follow-up articles, for example, in the Sunday Times, which attempted to link the whole situation to the Brexit Party by association. And the association in this case was that Richard Tice was in a relationship with Isabel Oakeshott, who had broken the story in the first place. Well, if you remember, that whole situation received quite a bit of criticism from the Assistant Commissioner for Counterterrorism at the Metropolitan Police, who said, I would advise all owners, editors and publishers of social and mainstream media not to publish leaked government documents that may already be in their possession or which may be offered to them, and to turn them over to the police or their rightful owner, Her Majesty's government. And this received quite a bit of criticism, as you can imagine, even amongst our controlled media as it is. They saw this as an effort to restrict their freedoms even further. And Neil Basu went on to say, the Metropolitan Police respects the rights of the media and has no intention of seeking to prevent editors from publishing stories in the public interest in a liberal democracy. The media holds an important role in scrutinising the actions of the state. So that was him trying to backtrack following the criticism. Well, Neil Basu was speaking at the annual Society of Editors conference in London yesterday, and he stuck mainly to that line. However, this is what he had to say. I do regret the impact of my statement at the time, not because of the effect on me, but because it risked damaging the relationship between the police and the media, mainly because I'm desperate to have a relationship with you that will help me fight terrorism. And he said that he really wanted to develop the relationship in the style of that the media has with the Samaritans. So with respect to suicides, it's not about the media reporting suicides, it's about how suicides get reported. So the media has, he said, a relationship with the Samaritans, and he wants to build a similar type of cooperative relationship with the media. So the question then is, Brian, where does that leave us if the Metropolitan Police and the government are in this cozy relationship with the media in the way that the Samaritans is, for example?
Participatory democracy, Mike, I believe. We're drawing in the charities and these other organisations to help make the government policy and to put it in place. It's a new form of government which is creeping in. And he's desperate, because they are desperate, they have got to have control of the media. That's really what they want. They want the media to only publish the stories they want published with the information that they're prepared to release. So he's a worried man. He overstepped the mark. He pushed the policy forward too quickly, paid the price, had to backstep a bit. But what are we watching in the liberal democracy? Well, of course, we're not in a liberal democracy. We're in a government of occupation. He's got to get control of the media in order that they can spin the stories about terrorism.
Absolutely. Now, with respect to the media and the election, we don't need to worry, because Full Fact has come to the rescue. They've published their fact-checking in the 2019 election research recommendations paper. And they're saying that fact checks, they're encouraging media organisations to run fact checks on the claims that are made with respect to the election. They are saying that this guide is designed to help well communicated and understood fact checks for newsrooms during the time of the general election. And they said that fact checks could be made more effective by including full relevant context, making them easy to read in short paragraphs without distracting visual elements, using a good image to improve veracity, attention and learning, provide a second dose of the corrected information, include some graphs to make things easily visualizable. They said that it's important that fact checks answers that are given clearly in the headline and throughout the article and explain how inaccuracies arose in the article in the first place. And they say that really, you know, you need to go back and encourage the original source to correct the facts if there's been a mistake made, because it's much more credible if the original source makes the correction first. The Guardian, it seems to be the first to have jumped on the fact-checking bandwagon for the election. So they have their fact-check section on the Guardian website, and they have begun with, will there really be 20,000 new police officers? So we can be relying on the mainstream media to make sure that every claim that's made during this general election is absolutely accurate and factual. I'm sure you're impressed.
I paused slightly there, Mike, because somebody in our chat box, I think, came up with a key question: who checks the fact checkers?
Yes.
And of course, Full Fact created itself, set itself up, received funding, put itself forward as the bona fide organisation to check facts. And now we're supposed to just accept them as being an authority on who said what.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful system. Let's have a look at a little bit of the stuff in the press and whether we like it or not. So The Guardian here, I found this one interesting. Let's remind ourselves of all the times men tried to assault us and failed. And this is a lady, Dorothy Byrne. We'll come on to her a bit more in a moment. But basically, she's got a very, very big axe to grind. Harassment and assault are commonplace, but we women, we're not always helpless victims. And I encourage people, as always, to go and read the article themselves so you can get the full flavour of it. In the article, she's been attacked and attempted rapes and attempted assaults. I mean, she's a very, very unlucky lady, because it appears that from the earliest age, when she was a young schoolgirl, she suffered attempted abductions and assaults, and later on it goes to rapes. It's very unlucky that for one woman this should happen to this extent. But she ends the article: the paedophile in the car didn't abduct me from my school. The young man on the country walk gave up. John Warboys misjudged me. Now, that was the cabbie who was actually drugging women in his cab. She thinks she got in. She couldn't swear in front of a court, but she's pretty sure she got in one of his cabs. On other days and nights, I was not so fortunate, and while physically and psychologically I survived those bad experiences, I know that it isn't possible for all women, but let's remind ourselves of all the times men tried to assault us and failed. We must recognise the enormity of what has been done to women and at the same time celebrate our daily victories. This is a very poisonous article, Mike, when you get into it, because this is helping to inflame division between men and women. Of course, if you're a young man, actually, you are at great risk of being assaulted, depending on where you are in a city, depending on what time of the day you're in that area. So if we look at assaults, it's not this clear cut. But why are we interested in this lady? Here she is reported in the Sunday Post. Broadcast news chief Dorothy Byrne reflects on how her ferocious and funny speech provoked a tumult. Now, she's head of news and current affairs at Channel 4. Let's have a look at her lecture here. The keynote speech at the annual Edinburgh Television Festival made headlines of its own after Byrne waded in to condemn male colleagues, past and possibly present, of abusing their position, gave a personal account of being harassed on the first day at work, suggest a previous McTaggart lecturer sexually assaulted women. That's quite a stacking up of stuff. She's got an agenda to run. We haven't seen real evidence to back up the claims that she's making, but this is being banged out. And of course, she's in a very powerful position there in as head of news and current affairs at Channel 4. But then look at what you tag with it. Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, they're cowards for dodging interviews. And she compares the Prime Minister to Vladimir Putin. But Putin doesn't duck interviews. He gives very long interviews and he gives very detailed answers in front of a range of national press. The lack of diversity in TV, or finding time to raise the subject of the menopause and men's ignorance about it. Is this lady fit to be producing mainstream news, or has she got a private agenda of her prejudices which she's running? I'll leave it to our viewers and listeners to decide, encourage you to look at the articles, but these are the type of people that are now in control of the media. On to the BBC. So here's the headline. Is climate change to blame for Australia's bushfires? When you get through the article, this is done on nothing but hearsay. So I've chosen these two inserted text on your screen. These run together. It's not that I've pulled them out from a different place in the article. So the first one, so are these bushfires due to climate change? And we get a response. This is course hearsay because there's no evidence to back it up, but here's what the gentleman said. We find it very difficult in general to attribute climate change impacts to a specific event, particularly while the event is running. And of course he's referring to the burning fires in Australia, and that's Dr. Richard Thornton, chief executive of the Bushfires and Natural Hazards Cooperative Research Centre. And then he says, but what we do know is that the average temperature in Australia is now running about 1 degree C above the long-term average. He added the seasons were starting earlier and the cumulative fire danger in many areas is growing. And then the piece they put in with that, Professor Glenda Wardle, an ecologist from the University of Sydney, agreed, it's not every weather event that is the direct result of climate change, but when you see trends, it becomes undeniably linked to global climate change. Oh. But there's no evidence to support that linkage which is put in. And so what is the BBC doing? Well, it's conflating information in order to give you the BBC line that the climate change is real. But it gets better than that, because the BBC saw another opportunity to use fires and presumably climate change to get back on the war of the sexes. So let's have a look at this one. And here we are, Australia bushfires, pregnant firefighter defends decision to fight fires. And where has this amazing story come from? Well, it's here, because this lady put out on Instagram a scan showing her unborn baby and said that even though she was 13 weeks pregnant, she was still going to go out and fight the fires. Now, on one hand, we could say, well, this is a gutsy lady. She's decided the risk for herself. She's going out to fight the fires. But of course, if something was to happen to her, then it would fall on her colleagues to put themselves at risk for her. So there's a debate here. But one Instagram, well, I'll call it a tweet, but a post, and the BBC's got a major story. And what is the story about? Well, this woman is going to go out and she's going to fight fires. And she says, I don't care if you don't like it. No, I'm not a man. Yes, I am pregnant. No, I don't care if you like it. So we've got the BBC now taking the fires, but now we've got back onto the war of the sexes. And that's being promoted as a real story. I think this is spin. But let's also just remind ourselves that the BBC's dark, very dark attack on the public mind is continuing. This is one I picked off the website today. This is being pushed very clearly in front of audiences. And this is one of these interactive articles where the moment you touch the screen to look at the text, you've got these very dark, depressing images that are coming up. This is not accidental, Mike. While the key issues of what's going to happen with the country and Brexit and the political mess that the country's in, I use the word a lot, but I'm going to use it again. This is the dross that the BBC is pushing across to confuse and dumb down the public mind. I think it's getting a bit obvious.
Okay, yesterday was a big day for EU Defence Union, and particularly for the second pillar there, PESCO. Now, in her press conference following the meeting, Federica Mogherini, who's still High Representative until the end of this month, was very keen to stress that EU-NATO cooperation has never been so positive, never been so concrete. So, of course, NATO being the right-hand most pillar on the Defence Union diagram, so that's pretty key. But the news, she said, for yesterday was that EU ministers had adopted 13 new projects under PESCO. That brings the total of PESCO projects up to 47. And she said that the EU has 16 missions ongoing under an EU flag. So that's pretty clear that these are not missions, bilateral missions or missions under the flags of nation member states. These are EU missions
yeah,
under an EU flag. Okay. Now, she said that the focus was on African missions. In fact, we've got a short little clip here, so let's just listen to this little bit.
Focus was put on our African missions, in particular in the Sahel. We decided to increase our presence and improve the level of support we are giving to our Sahel partners.
Now, this is really critical. This is something that the EU for quite some time now has seen, an area of the world where they've seen that they have a real role. And it's particularly important. Now, back in February, as the UK columnist highlighted on a number of occasions, Ursula von der Leyen, who was the German defence minister at the time, who's going to replace Jean-Claude Juncker as the president of the European Commission, she had said at the time that, of course, the Sahel area of Africa, an area that NATO isn't really interested in, an area that the EU needs to be very interested in because this is the EU's southern neighbourhood. So again, yesterday we've got more emphasis on that. And of course, if you were watching the news on Monday, you'll have seen this report we covered from the Oxford Research Group, which is all about the UK government pushing its fusion doctrine out internationally to all the countries that the UK gets involved with. They want to roll out fusion. And one of the key points they made in this document is that the EU and its member states are projected to spend 8 billion euros on development assistance in the Sahel alone, along with billions more on security, capacity planning and other programs between 2014 and 2020. The UK is also a member of the Sahel Alliance, which was set up by France, Germany and the EU to focus on increasing coordination between partners working in the region. So what we have is a situation where the UK claims to be not part of PESCO, the EU working extremely hard to make sure that third countries can cooperate in PESCO, because the UK is certainly part of some of the PESCO projects.
Yep.
But the UK is through EI2 and also through the Sahel Alliance is also very interested in this region of Africa as well. Now, why would that be? Because as Patrick mentioned on the programme on Monday, this is going to be the breadbasket of the world in the coming years. And it is being developed very strongly by the Chinese and by the Russians. So we now have the situation that the Chinese, the Russians, the EU, Britain and the United States, indirectly through recent developments with respect to NATO, suddenly getting interested in the area themselves. We are going to see these major powers coming together in this region and competing for influence in this region. And this seems like, as we said on Monday's programme, an extremely dangerous situation.
It's very dangerous. The other thing it underlines, Mike, is EU Defence Union, because can we pop that one just back on screen?
Yes.
We've got the two key things there. We've got the money. So we've been warning that, of course, alongside EU Defence Union, this single point control of all the military across Europe, you needed money to back that up. There needed to be a lot of money. There needed to be a treasury. So we've got eight billion here coming in, with billions more on security. So there's the money coming in. And then the second paragraph there, the UK is also a member of the Sahel Alliance, which was set up by France, Germany and the EU. Now that statement is disingenuous, because if you're dealing with France, you are automatically dealing with the EU. If you're dealing with Germany, you're automatically dealing with the European Union.
I'm just going to qualify that a little bit, if I may, because you're right. You're right to focus on this. It's very important. What that paragraph is saying is that France is an institution, an organization, a country. Yeah. Germany, the same. The EU is now of a similar bent. It has a flag. It has its own military capability developing. And therefore, they're putting the EU alongside France and Germany because it will have its own foreign policy and its own defence policy and its own defence capability. So in that sense, it has equity with France, Germany and the UK.
Yep.
But of course, because it under the defence union will have single point command and control, it becomes superior to France, Germany and the UK.
Automatically.
Absolutely.
Automatically superior. So what we can say is that while the British government, while Boris Johnson's Conservative government is busy talking Brexit, the proof is in front of our very eyes that out there, Boris Johnson and of course Theresa May and previous governments have signed UK's military capability into these EU defence union operations. They're going on. It's not they're not going on, they are going on. So the big lie is Brexit, because our military has been signed over to EU defence union.
Absolutely. Now if you remember, the left hand pillar of defence union is the bilateral and multilateral agreements. EI2 is one. If you want to know a bit more about EI2, head over to the UK column website. It's because the headline article is discussing that. But of course, one of the other it's a trilateral agreement in this case, was highlighted by Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer a week or so ago, the German defence minister, the current German defence minister, who said, Brexit or not, the island, that's Britain, won't just sail away. It remains part of our security architecture. I therefore propose that we make permanent the E3 format that emerged around the Iran question. Well, the E3 format continues to work and it continues to issue statements. And again, the E3 has issued a joint statement with the High Representative of the European Union, Federica Mogherini, on the Iran nuclear deal and the latest developments. And they said that the foreign ministers of France, Germany, the United Kingdom and the High Representative of the European Union are extremely concerned by the latest announcements that Iran is restarting uranium enrichment activities at the Fordo facility, as confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Agency in its 11 November report. And they went on to say, we urge Iran to reverse all measures inconsistent with the JCPOA. So this statement being released today on this. But again, once again, we find that E3 is an operational multilateral agreement. The German defence minister wants that to be formalised into a permanent situation, because again, that ties Britain into EU Defence Union.
Yeah, that is the key thing, EU Defence Union. But now we're upping the stakes. We're not just talking about Africa. We're into Iran and potentially major conflict.
Yes. Now, just before we come on to the money aspects of supporting Defence Union in a second, I just wanted to highlight this article in the Mail today, because on Monday, of course, we led off with the death of James Le Mesurier, the founder of the White Helmets. Well, true to form and unsurprisingly, the Mail have decided to cover it in this way. Why do so many Russian enemies plunge to their death from balconies after ex-army officer James Le Mesurier found dead at the foot of his Istanbul flat? Just what is the truth about the brutal end of of a quiet British hero. And they list a number of other incidents they claim are Russian assassinations or Russian-related assassinations where people were apparently pushed from high places. And they highlight, of course, that his death came barely 3 days after the Kremlin publicly accused him of being an MI6 spy. The dashing 48-year-old father of two was found dead in the street in downtown Istanbul. So this is an unbelievable propaganda piece. Well, the Mail should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, it should be fact-checked, Mike. That's what should happen to that. Full fact should get off their bottoms and they should get fact-checking that article. But it's a Russian smear campaign. If you make a statement that this man's connected with the deep state, that's just a smear campaign. Mm. Just push that to one side.
Yep.
It's disgraceful reporting.
Okay, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. There are various options to help us out there. In fact, you can now get hold of vouchers for, well, you can give them away as Christmas gifts. These are lifetime membership, annual membership vouchers to allow you to buy UK Column memberships as gifts for people at Christmas. They're available on the UK Column website if you would like to do that.
And we can add there, Mike, that they have proved to be popular. Several people have already said, yes, please.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And a quick reminder that if you want to see the presentations that were given at AV 10.1 a couple of weeks ago, those videos are available through the UK Column website as well. Head onto the ukcolumn.org front page and you'll see the article there that you can go and have a look at. Now, Brian mentioned a second ago money and the money that's behind Defence Union. And of course, as he said, there needs to be a treasury. Now, if we think back to the middle of 2018 or so, Donald Tusk had this to say, I will do everything in my power to take the very first concrete steps by June, that was June 2018, towards establishing the European Monetary Fund and strengthening the stability of the banking union. Now, the European Monetary Fund is the embryonic treasury. Our focus for discussion today is the stability of the banking union. Now, in fact, the banking union has a lot of opposition and has had a lot of opposition within the EU. And this is why we sort of saw Donald Tusk at that time becoming a little bit frustrated with that and making threats, because he went on to say that he would name and shame anybody that stood in the way of banking union. That was in the middle of 2018, and very little has happened since. Now, for anybody that doesn't know what the banking union is, let's have a quick look. You'll love the graphic. This is an official EU graphic in the top left-hand side there.
That's the one-eyed man.
Absolutely.
I think that Muslim viewers would be fascinated with that, because I think we're here almost with the devil looking at a magnifying glass.
Well, there you go. And yeah. So banking union, it's essentially... they say it's an essential complement to the economic and monetary union. It will align responsibility for supervision, resolution and funding at EU level, and it forces banks across the euro area to abide by the same rules. And they're saying that banking union will include, amongst other things, a single deposit insurance fund for the EU, and it will also include the transformation of the European Stability Mechanism into a universal bailout fund. Now, this is the latest proposal from the Germans, who have suddenly decided that they want to inject some momentum back into this. Bloomberg was reporting this by saying that Merkel opens door to deputies' plan for Europe's banking union. This was highlighting a press conference yesterday that she was holding with the Italian premier. And she said at that press conference, the banking union must be completed to safeguard the stability of the euro. So they are clearly extremely concerned about the stability of the euro. They've suddenly realized that there's a risk to the stability of the euro as a result of the current financial situation. And so they want to make sure that they can reinforce that. But a single deposit insurance fund for the EU and basically a uniform regulatory process across the EU is something that they've been working hard towards for quite some time. It's one of the key institutions that needs to be in place for Hofstadt's EU empire, along with, and of course it supports, the Defence Union.
Yes, So perhaps it'd be a good time to say to our viewers and for listeners, if you haven't written to your MP asking them the key question about EU Defence Union and what the commitment of that is, what that means for British Armed Forces, push for those replies. It will be a good time to do it because, of course, with the elections coming up, MPs, as they always do, are suddenly getting nervous. All they're really worried about is keeping their seats. Mm. So letters, polite but firm, factual letters asking these key questions start to put them under enormous pressure, and we will be very interesting in responses. Well, while all of this is going on, the subject of children is never far from the headline, and we were fascinated by this one in The Guardian. 30 years on, has the Children Act changed family life for the better? Politicians, social workers, parents and legal experts discuss whether the far-reaching act has been successful at putting children's interests first. Well, The Guardian seems to have trouble in working out that, of course, children are on the bad end of what's happening. But let's have a look at their article because it's fascinating. Who have they chosen to write this article? Well, it's none other than Virginia Bottomley, former health minister. They've dragged her out of the very long and very old grass because she was in post in 1995. And let's have a look at the remarkable thing she said. The Children's Act was a culmination of many years' preparation following dissatisfaction around children's legislation. It brought together private and public law affecting children and reinforced the principle that the welfare of the child must be paramount and their interests separately considered. This critical concept that children are not possessions. They actually have rights of their own. Now that children are not possessions, what I think that is a sideswipe that they don't actually have anything to do with parents. Mm. I may be wrong on that, but I think that's what that little statement means. So she goes on, in my former life, I was chair of the juvenile court in Lambeth. I worked in a child guidance clinic and I was a trustee of the Children's Society. So my preoccupation has been with children's well-being. It was a key reason I came into Parliament to be the minister responsible for the implementation of an act I had so much confidence in. Was a real delight and extremely rewarding. One of my objectives was to promote understanding of the role of social workers. Well, she certainly did that because she said this next. One of my objectives was to promote understanding of the role of social workers. I used to say they were victims of ritualistic abuse. Either they were castigated for leaving children within the family so long, or they were castigated for removing the children too fast, as in the Cleveland child abuse scandal, achieving recognition that removing a child had to be a decision with many stakeholders and that the social worker's role was a particularly difficult one, was part of my message. She says that the social workers were victims of ritualistic abuse. But of course, when children come forward talking about ritualistic abuse, this is all conspiracy theory and nonsense. There's something extremely odd in these words, Mike, by this woman.
Was Cleveland not a ritualistic abuse situation?
We've had a number of them. So Cleveland, I should know off the top of my head, and I'm afraid I don't.
I think that she used that as an example is very interesting.
That makes that one even more interesting. But of course, children who are standing up and saying that they were subject to this type of abuse, this is now being turned on its head. So she says, I think the rights of children need to continue to be argued for now. Children can't speak for themselves. They don't have a vote. Their rights need to be reaffirmed by every new generation of politicians. It's easy to unconsciously turn a blind eye to child abuse and neglect. That's why legislation like the Children Act has constantly to be reinforced. So suddenly we've got major concern about the Children Act, and of course, rights of the child. Do children actually get rights? Not really. The rights get taken away from the children because they can't stay with their parents, they're in care, they're abused, they speak out, nobody wants to listen. So the article got into a lot of detail. I can only just give a bit, but there was quotes here. So we've got Al Ainley Green, former Children's Commissioner of England. I'm calling for a Royal Commission on Childhood to scope the realities of the lives of children. We need a Royal Commission set up so that we can actually understand what children are all about. We don't understand as parents, but we need a Royal Commission. That's interesting. We've got Ruth Scotton, social worker and adoptive parent. Now, some of these comments are bringing in reality. Children may be removed from their parents because of the risk of harm, but I don't think there's enough understanding of the risk of harm from separation and the long-term impact of that. So that's a reasonable question, but she could have also said the risk to children of being abused in the care system itself. But that doesn't get mentioned. Steve Walker, Director of Children's Services Leeds, limiting resources has limited our ability to provide services. All he's interested in is money. We haven't got enough money to look after the children. Give us more money and the children will be properly looked after. And on it goes. Kathy Ashley, CEO of the Family Rights Group. What we now see is that these provisions of the Act are too often viewed through the lens of child protection, not family support. There should also be greater emphasis on keeping family siblings together. They're also talking about keeping families together. That's common sense. But what is this article really trying to achieve? Annie, mother of children taken into care. The upshot is that across the country, primarily in poor communities, families are frightened. Confidence in the family courts is low. It's a spiral that's hard to get out of, but the only way to make a start is return to the ethos of the Children's Act. So that's a pretty heartfelt statement. Well, let's have a look at what the president of the Family Division High Court says. There's no clamour, not even a whisper, that the basic concepts of child law now need further reform. The architects of the legislation and its draftsmen simply got it right. And so he said there's absolutely nothing to worry about. It's all working perfectly, no problems. Meanwhile, we've got the ICSA child abuse inquiry quietly whitewashing over children, saying, well, we were taken from our parents, we were abused by foster carers and adoptive parents, we were abused in care, we spoke out, and all that happened was we were imprisoned for some of them. So Guardian article, it doesn't say what the purpose of this story is, but we are extremely interested in Virginia Bottomley spinning reality onto ritualistic abuse is what the social workers suffer. Something not quite right.
Okay, look, we're going to end with Hong Kong today because the situation over there just gets worse and worse. And so does the mainstream media coverage of it. So this is Associated Press. Hong Kong police shoot protester, man set on fire. This is their headline. And the implication from that headline is that, it's a very clever headline. The implication is that the Hong Kong police shot a protester and that they set a man on fire. But what's interesting is that you read through the article and the fact that a man was set on fire isn't ever mentioned again.
Right.
So this is deliberately constructed to bring the idea to people's minds that the Hong Kong police are being extremely heavy-handed with what's going on with the protests over there. So let's look elsewhere for the circumstances. Now, I'm going to say ahead of this that what we're going to show another website here, but there's an embedded video clip on this website and it's extremely disturbing. So if anybody is sensitive, I suggest you look away, because this is what happened with respect to the man who was set on fire. He had flammable material thrown over him by protesters because he was arguing with the protesters. They then ran away and he was set on fire. He's in critical condition in hospital. I haven't heard whether he has survived at this point, but this is Global Times here. Hong Kong rioters act similar to terrorists. And this is clearly the Chinese government line here. And they are saying that this is you would say an opinion piece, but they're clearly suggesting that people are starting to lose patience with the situation. They're, as I say, calling the protesters, they're saying that they're acting like terrorists, that they run the risk of being shot dead on the spot. As a mainland media concerned with the ongoing situation in Hong Kong, they say the Global Times firmly supports the Hong Kong police in shooting down the rioters under the above-mentioned circumstances. The use of force by the Hong Kong police re-established the power of legal justice that was despised by radical protesters. Attacking and threatening the police in the protest of law enforcement should face all kinds of legal risks, including being shot dead on the spot. And they criticise the judges in Hong Kong for being pretty lenient with protesters so far by allowing them to apply for bail on easy terms and handing down extraordinary light sentences has also served to encourage human terrorist acts. So far, more than 3,000 people have been arrested for various offences, including assault, occasioning bodily harm and arson during the 5 months of turbulence, but none of the arrestees has been jailed. Thanks to the judicial leniency, many rioters have made themselves repeat offenders. And while that might seem like quite a strong response from the Chinese media, it has to be said that the behaviour of the so-called protesters, who, let's remember, are UK and US backed, it has been absolutely despicable. They are going out of their way this is not yellow vest style protest where the government forces are throwing plastic bullets and things like this back in their faces. This is pretty grotesque violence that's going on here. Yeah. They're attempting to take guns from the police. They're attempting to set people on fire, as they have done in this case. While I don't agree with any calls for people to be shot dead, I certainly do agree that the judiciary in Hong Kong have so far been pretty lenient on those carrying out these atrocities.
Do we know more about who has actually caused this, or what the purpose of what's going on? Is this politically stirred?
It is politically stirred by the UK, the US, and the usual suspects. Like Open Society and these types of organisations, yes.
Right, that says
it all. We'll have more to say about this in the coming days and weeks.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of today's news. Thank you all very much for joining us. Particularly big thank you to those of you that have joined us for overseas. If you're not already a subscriber of UK Column, please consider taking out a subscription. We can only do what we do with your help. And I'll just end by saying I was with a really exciting group of people yesterday from many different professions and sectors of society, but people who are saying there is something badly wrong in this country, there's something badly wrong with our press, with media reporting. We are going to stand up to be counted of our own accord. So some really tremendous people who are out there talking about what is really happening to do with green issues, warning about the risks from 5G, talking about the use of fake news and propaganda in the mainstream press. It was really encouraging stuff. And I'm going to also say a big thank you to our host, who provided a unique venue for that group of people to come together. It's clear, Mike, that a lot of people are really trying now to do something to overturn this blatant propaganda that's being pushed by the government of the United Kingdom. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.